Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our spotlight is going to be on the miniseries, yes, the miniseries, the original version of The Singing Detective. Let's put out of mind and out of sight the terrible Robert Downey Jr. movie. That's an abomination. We're speaking about the original Dennis Potter written, John Amiel directed, Michael Gambon starring BBC miniseries from 1986. Joining me tonight are my guests, Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Perry Seibert. Say hello.
Hi, Toots.
And Gregory Runfeld, who's joining us again after a long hiatus. It's been since, what, Hi, Matt, about 4 months ago?
Yeah, it actually has. It has been. It's been far too long. Good evening, everybody.
So, you know, now this is of course, a work from Dennis Potter. We'll get into him later. But I do want to ask everyone how we first came to the show. So, Perry, how did we first come to this show?
So my friends, my parents had a very close friend who was a good friend of the family, who was one of the cooler people I ever knew. Her name was Janet Myers, and Janet Myers loved four things in life. She loved basketball, she loved literature, she loved rock and roll, and she loved smoking pot. And it really, whatever of those she most loved depended on who was playing, what she was reading, what was on the stereo, and what she had to smoke. It didn't matter at any given time. She gave me a list of books to read when I was a teenager, 14, 15, 16. And I had not gone through all of them, but I read many of them over the years, and the one thing that wasn't a book on the list was The Singing Detective. And I had always wanted to see it, and I'd never sought it out. I'd never had the opportunity fall in front of me until a few weeks ago when you asked me if I would be interested in doing this show and telling me that it's all on YouTube. So I have just seen it for the first time. And so I have known about it for decades and been very eager to see it and am very thrilled that I have.
Yeah, it's a pretty spectacular work, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. Jan
yep.
had great taste.
Yep. So, Aaron, what's your story of coming to this?
It's Perry's story minus the cool friend. you'd told me about this. I told you that I wanted to start getting serious about a miniseries list because I love lists because I'm a nerdy man, and nerdy men love lists. And
yes.
I didn't have a miniseries list, and I wanted one. And so you gave me a list of miniseries to watch. And so it sat around on my list for a while now. And then you said you were going to do it. And so I also watched it about a month ago now when we first, right around the time we watched Brideshead Revisited, too. So.
And finally to you, Gregory, how did you come to this?
I don't have a story as spectacular as the others do. I simply was in a video store and just came across it. I always like, as you know, Adam and I, as you and I have discussed, I am a very, my first love is our films and my second are miniseries. So I saw it, you know, I love BBC stuff, and I just rented it because I just liked the way it looked. A lot of times it's just that instinctual thing I have. And what was interesting is my PBS station, as good as it was, it aired at Berlin Alexanderplatz, right? That's where I first saw that. They never aired Pennies from Heaven or Singing Detective, as far as I knew, because I probably would have watched it, you know? but they never. Yeah, the WTTW affiliate, the Chicago affiliate WTTW where I grew up, never showed it. But it was just simply going into the video store and saying, "Hey, this looks cool." So the rest is history, because like the first couple, it really grabbed you right away, you know, in that first episode.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it never lets go, which is what, you know, television and film are supposed to do. So.
Yeah, no. My own story is that I was aware of it. I was aware of it actually prior to the movie, and I was curious about the movie, but I'd wanted to see the miniseries first. Well, the local library didn't have it to to borrow, because somebody had stolen their copy.
They just borrowed it permanently. That's all. They'll return it.
So I went several years. I never did see the movie until after I'd seen the miniseries. I saw the miniseries about 6 years ago. It sits number 15 all time on my programs list, if that tells you how highly I regard it. The reason I did finally see it again was not only was it something that I wanted to see, but when I began my top 300 project, my good friend Alan Fish, who's been gone, wow, it's been way too long now, still can't believe it's coming up on 5 years, told me, if you don't make this a priority, I will swim across the Atlantic and knock you senseless. So I did. And I watched it, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. It is really a great show. So that's my story. For those who don't know, because we kind of jumped into this, what is this show really about? Let's start with you, Perry. You haven't had a chance to talk, so if you could give a brief synopsis of the series, how would you describe it? What would you say it's about?
My TV Guide blurb? Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
that would be
your TV Guide blurb.
That would be a mystery writer with a debilitating illness, hallucinates, and lives in his mind. Now I'm going to leave the TV Guide format. And over the course of 6 hours, you pretty much understand everything you need to know about this person. You get the full psychological accounting of a human being over the course of close to 7 hours, really.
Yeah.
Mhm. Mhm. So I'm going to go with Gregory on this one, because I know that he's seen a lot of Potter. I don't think you've seen any other Potter, right, Aaron?
Correct.
Have you seen any other works of Potter, like maybe Pennies from Heaven or Brimstone and Treacle, Perry? Or is this your only Potter so far?
Only the other adaptations. Like I've seen the Herbert Ross Pennies from Heaven, and I've seen I forget who directed the other Brimstone and Treacle, the one with Sting. I've seen those, but I have not gone to I have not seen the original miniseries of either.
So you might be able to talk a little bit about this, but I think this question is going to be mainly for Gregory. So the question is, how does this fit in for you to Potter's other works?
Well, this one is really – well, this was actually the first one that I saw, and it's like that always makes an indelible impression. It's like the first Tarkovsky film I saw was Solaris, and I still like – you know, that's still like – had that initial visceral impact. But with this one, it's actually his most surreal work. There are times when I think like it's all a dream, right? It's all like one big long hallucination. And it's not really supposed to be like understood like logically or rationally. It's almost like an art film, and that it just happens to be a 7-hour art film. Kind of like Berlin Alexanderplatz, especially like the last episode of that, which is like
a
2-hour
hallucination. We've gone
basically
off the rails, but we haven't.
Yeah. And sometimes that's how Singing Detective comes across to me, and it's, I think that's one of the reasons I like it so much, because it's very, like, you know, you're not really sure what happened, but something significant did, you know, so, and I always like ambiguity like that.
So do you feel that that goes into the rest of Potter's work?
You said
it might be his most surreal. So do you feel that he was quite a realistic writer then?
Pennies from Heaven, I mean, he did have the musical numbers, but the story itself is like a realistic depiction of, you know, there's not as big a surreal tone. And then I saw like three films that he did for British television, Cream in My Coffee, Blade on the Feather, and Rain on the Roof. And those are all relatively straightforward dramas. And
yeah.
So this Singing Detective seems like, I don't want to say an anomaly, because it makes it sound like it sticks out completely from the rest of his work, which it really does not. But it does feel like, you know, that is like the one that's like the most, you know, like surreal, whether is it really happening or is it not happening. The others definitely, you know, are happening, so to speak. Even Pennies from Heaven, you know, all those fantasies that Bob Hoskins has, you know, with the songs and everything, doesn't deter the fact that, like, you know, he's a murderer and, you know, he's going to the gallows for his crimes and all that, so.
Yeah. No, it's that's a powerful one, and we're going to have to do an episode on that eventually, maybe later this year.
Yeah. And also, just want to say one thing. I have not seen the film version of Singing Detective, and I will take your word for it and not see it. Because Pennies from Heaven, the film, was a decent film, but it felt like a trailer to me. And then when you see the miniseries, you're like, oh, this is what they cut out, right? So,
yeah, you know, the thing
Singing
is, the
Singing Detective
movie.
Singing Detective is probably going to be terrible. Yeah.
But the Pennies from Heaven movie, the Herbert Ross one, I don't hate it by any means.
Yeah.
I actually really admire some of it, particularly the scene in the diner where with the actual Pennies from Heaven sequence.
Right.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I may actually prefer that sequence to the one in the miniseries. And it's not because it's more glitzy or glossy or refined. I just think that the choreography brings, and the way that the staging and everything is, brings out the emotion of the moment, and I felt more in tune with the themes in that one section than I did in that same section in the miniseries. And then the miniseries, it's great, but then you see the movie, and that's the one piece of the movie that for me beats its counterpart in the miniseries.
You are correct. The best thing about the Pennies from Heaven film are the musical numbers, the stagings. It's extremely elaborate. It's beautifully done, you know, and that makes the film worth watching. Even if you've seen the miniseries, you're going to go into the film. It's not going to be thematically, it won't be as good, but aesthetically, the musical numbers and the production values of the film make it worth seeing, even though it's still not as good, but it's not a waste of time at all. And it's better if you see the miniseries to see the film afterwards instead of vice versa.
Yeah. Yep. So now I will turn the same question to you, since you've seen some other Potter stuff. Compared to the scant bit of Potter stuff you've seen, Perry, how does this seem to fit into the rest of Potter's work?
Yeah, I don't feel real comfortable answering this other than to continue for a moment and say, I mean, if for no other reason, see Pennies from Heaven just to watch Christopher Walken dance. It's one of the greatest things you can see.
I think he was trained as a he had dance training when he
oh,
was
yeah.
one of the yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was a stage song and dance man, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's why it's so great when he's in Weapon of Choice.
Right. Absolutely, absolutely. I will say that, you know, I knew a lot about this before watching it. I mean, I was certainly aware of what The Singing Detective was, and only having to compare it off those other two, and knowing that the Pennies from Heaven came from a miniseries as well, you know, I feel in no way comfortable saying how this fits in, other than to say, over the three things I have seen, with the Herbert Ross version of Pennies from Heaven doing this the least of them, I mean, you can see how he's absolutely drawn to and can beautifully draw a very disturbed human being. Not one who cannot be saved. I don't mean to say just bad people. I just mean someone who is truly at a what do I want to call it? Let's say a mental turning point in their life.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to turn to my next question, which is kind of a general one. Where do we rank this among all-time miniseries and programs? Aaron?
Hi. I it's in my top 10. I number 7.
Yeah.
Number 7 all time on my miniseries, and 4 of the ones ahead of it are like all time movies, like Fanny and Alexander, Berlin, Alexander Platt, Decalogue, that kind of stuff. So,
yep, you and I are in lockstep.
Yeah, like, it's high on the list.
Yeah, because for me, it's Fanny and Alexander, Haymont, Decalogue, Berlin, Alexander Platt's, GBH, and then The Singing Detective, and GBH, if you guys haven't seen it, is another must-see.
I concur with Adam. GBH is extraordinary. It's also a very dark miniseries too, which really caught me off guard. Its tone is very, very cynical, and when you see Michael Palin plays a dramatic role, but he's fantastic.
Palin's best work.
Yeah, you don't even think about Python when you're watching him.
No. So I have to ask Aaron, I forget, did you say you bought a copy of GBH recently?
Yep.
Cool. When you get to it, I guess you and Gregory and I are going to have to do an episode on this because, this is it.
This weekend.
Yeah, and watch the interview with Alan Bleasdale on the DVD. It's very illuminating.
Did you mean to name it Great Bodily Harm? Oh, heavens no. It's Great British Holiday.
Raymond Massey is so funny in that series.
The whole series, but my God. Perry, what about you? Where do you rank this?
Oh, I think my answer was stolen. Hi. I don't have a ready to go list of miniseries ranks. It's superb. I absolutely understand why it has the reputation it does. I am very happy to have finally seen it.
Yeah, it really is one of those ones where, you know, these are all works of art and entertainment, but sometimes you come upon that one work where, yeah, sure, you can rank it if that's what you need to or somebody asks you to do, but you just go, shit, I'm glad I fucking saw the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely one of those. And it really does feel like one of those real kind of landmark, you know, everybody really that's interested in the form should see this type of thing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I would rate it as one of the, definitely top 10, perhaps maybe top 5, because I've watched a lot of miniseries, but that one is probably one of the most, you know, like I said earlier, it's like really etched in one's really etches itself in one's mind. Probably
I've got it at number 6.
Yeah, number six is good. That's a good ranking. It's up there with Berlin Alexander Plot, Fanny and Alexander, I, Claudius, another great miniseries would be up there as well, Brideshead Revisited. And even Pennies from Heaven, you know, you could, like, put them back to back. I mean, you know, both are tremendous works. And, you know, it's always funny, and Adam, and we've talked about this, about how today you always see people act like long-form TV is somehow new. Obviously it isn't. They've been doing it since the 60s. And I was on a thread, on a Criterion thread in Facebook not too long ago, and they were talking about Berlin Alexander Plots, and the people were talking about how they were just like, damn, I thought stuff today was deep. This thing is like 1,000 times deeper than anything you're getting today. And, you know, mm-hmm. while there are very good shows today, I'm not going to, you know, there are very good shows today. I think actually The Singing Detective, you know, is, I don't think there's anything really comparable today like that. That just, you know, I mean, some people would probably obviously disagree with that, but I think that, you know, The Singing Detective is a tremendous work, a profound work, along with Alexander Plots, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, the only thing I can possibly compare it to in terms of overall quality and inventive daringness is Better Call Saul, which I'm not in the camp that thinks it's better than Breaking Bad, but I definitely think that if you want to say you prefer it to Breaking Bad or think that it is a better show than Breaking Bad, I'm not going to look at you cross-eyed, because there are moments in that show where I'm like, wow, this beats a lot of Breaking Bad, but I'm still not ready yet to call it. And I'm still deciding if I'm going to maybe one day connect or, you know, just put Breaking Bad
for the Walter White cameo, aren't you?
And yeah, I'm thinking about maybe just putting like Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, / El Camino, all as one entity, the way I do with some other things like Babylon 5, Crusade, and Band of Brothers, Pacific, Both Sides of the Hollow Crown. But, you know, we've talked a little bit about what the show's about, but I'll go to you, Aaron. What did you find to be the major themes of this particular program?
Pain. I think that everything in this series after he first comes in, maybe not every moment, but every major moment, is just a hallucination or a dream from his pain. We see a lot of nasty stuff happening even in the hospital, and it's just an escape for him. Obviously, it also touches on emotional pain. His mother obviously deeply scarred him in his views of women. I think that it would not be difficult for somebody who is not watching carefully to think that the Singing Detective itself has a harsh view of women. I don't think it does. I think that Philip Marlowe does. And it all goes back to his mother. So I think that's a very important aspect of it, too, is his relationship with his mother and his wife and the nurse, kind of his trinity of women. But ultimately, it's about pain, physical and emotional and mental anguish.
Which is something Potter knew quite a bit about, given that Potter suffered from the same psoriatic arthritis that Marlowe does, and believe it or not, at times Potter's arthritis was even worse than what we saw Marlowe endure, to the point that, yes, he also had to have his pen tied to his hand, and his skin was often cracked and bleeding. So, yeah, he knew from whence he spoke. So pain, that works. Perry?
That's a really good answer. It's a better answer than anything I'm going to say. And I will double down on pain by saying that I had the very weird experience of right when it ended, my normal instinct when seeing something, that great is, I can't wait to watch this again. And I said that to myself, and I thought, yes, I can. I don't need to go right back through this anytime soon. And that's the reason, not because I didn't like it, just because, I have a hard time calling this entertaining. It's funny. It's brilliant. I mean, I agree with what we said earlier. It's entertaining as an art film. I can't just throw this at anybody and say, hey, dig on 7 hours of this. That's not going to fly for many, many people. But for those of us that do like this kind of thing, who don't mind 7 hours on pain, that's why it works so well. it does. None of those sequences are really escapist. They're almost scary. They're such hallucinations. There's not levity in this outside of some really great, hard-boiled dialogue that is obviously there to be so entertaining. And of course, listening to Michael Gambon fire off withering remarks to anybody is going to be entertaining. But for the most part, thematically, no, this is a really serious endeavor. And I think that nails it perfectly. Yeah, it is about pain. And oddly enough, even though I think, it holds out, I think it not holds out hope. I think it very much says at the end, you can surpass that. You can work through that. There's not a feeling of triumph at the end of this by any means.
Yep. So what about you, Gregory?
Yeah, I would say, is it about pain? Yeah, that's part of it. It's about the, it's almost like he goes through, the comparative Berlanga's underpass, it's almost like he goes through a Franz Bibikoff type of ordeal, except actually Franz is a little bit worse. It's just about maybe the heaviness of existence, and, that causes, obviously can cause pain for many people, for all of us, really. I mean, life can be very difficult, as we know. So I think, it is partly like the pain he has to endure from all these maladies that afflict him, the skin disease, he's got the hard boiled attitude towards things, And also, as we know, as you mentioned, Potter had the same skin afflictions that Gambon's character has. So, that gives it a little bit more, substance, or a little bit more poignancy. And as everybody was saying, this is heavy stuff, right? You can't just when you recommend stuff like this, you can't really just tell somebody, oh, it's a singing detective, there's musical numbers in it, and let them think like it's a musical, which technically, yeah, there are musical numbers in there, but, you're going to be dealing with some really heavy stuff, and you're going to be like, oh, man, goes inside, everything, they would say, writing in between the lines, that's what Potter would do, So, and actually sometimes it's fun to jump into big things without knowing too much stuff in there, and it's like, yes, it's heavy. It's going to be 4 hours or whatever, 5 hours, but it's go on the journey, see what happens. You can always step, it's not a train. It's not a moving train. You can get off anytime you want, it's a TV show. So,
The next question, and I'll pose this to Perry, is, the show is unusual in its approach. How would you describe it to those, the approach of the show, how would you describe it to the uninitiated?
I will sort of answer that by saying this. the only the thing that it put me in mind of fairly early on, the only thing that I thought, this is what this, if it has a forebearer, it is this. And it was actually, it's Bob Fosse's All That Jazz. And they are, I think, incredibly similar, except that one is made for television, meaning it has the time to go 7 hours, and one is a two-hour movie.
Yeah, that's
they
a good comparison.
And for me, and now, and this is where, and I don't, I am not slagging on The Singing Detective at all by saying this. This is an issue of taste. All That Jazz is one of my 10 favorite movies. I think it is peerless. And so I couldn't help but I kept holding them and comparing them as I watched this. Not that it was coming up short. It was just, oh, I see how this is like this and how it does it a little bit differently and how they have more time and how that is sometimes good and sometimes not as good for me, just as my own personal taste. So I would say that, you know, if you've seen All That Jazz and you love All That Jazz and you are comfortable with a perspective that shifts in and out of reality and you aren't exactly sure where you are at any point, then yeah, you're going to be comfortable with that. And if you're not, this is going to be rough sledding for a while. And I might have you start with All That Jazz just so you can, which draws those lines a little more clearly. This is terrible verbiage. My favorite reveal, I hate saying that, it doesn't sound right, but just structurally, my favorite thing in the movie, in the miniseries, is finding out that you're actually seeing a reenactment of his old book, The Singing Detective, and then trying to figure out, why are we doing this? And that they're able to draw that thread into this as well. So good. So satisfying. Such beautiful writing. And by writing, I mean structure. I don't even want to say to get away with that or to pull it off. To have conceived of it and done it is so smart and so great. I can only say that it is kaleidoscopic. I have no other term for it. And once you get your bearings, I guess I would argue that by the time it's done, I feel like I understood where everything was. You're lost while you're in it, but at the end, I'm not left with any questions. I know what everything is. Mm-hmm. both structurally of what I was seeing and when I was seeing it, and Philip Marlowe as a character. I understand him fully. I have no questions left by the end of it, which is, you know, I'm not denigrating or complimenting for that. That's just how it is, and it's such a full experience in that capacity. Wow, I got to answer that one straight up, didn't I?
Well, you know, Potter's a hell of a writer, but I'll go to Gregory next. So, what about how do you look at this question? How will you answer it?
I'm sorry. What was the question again?
The question is, you know, the show is unusual in its approach. So how would you describe it to the uninitiated?
Oh, okay. Yeah, it is unusual. It's like what I mentioned before, surreal. The comparison to All That Jazz is a great, great comparison. And All That Jazz is one of my top, like, 20 films, right? So, and Perry? Was that his name?
Yep.
Okay, as Perry said, you know, it's basically Singing Detective is a 7 hour, is in many ways a 7 hour film version of like what All That Jazz, what Roy Gideon goes through, except, you know, Gideon, actually All That Jazz has a sadder ending, as we know, because Philip Marlowe does not die at the end. It's like that surreal trip again. And that you're just seeing, like, this guy's life. It's almost, in many ways, it's sometimes, you know, All That Jazz got compared to, like, Fellini's eight, you know, films at 8.5, right? So, you know, it's almost like Potter's making an autobiography of himself, you know, with that miniseries. Just like Fellini made the autobiography about himself at 8.5, and Bob Fosse did that with All That Jazz, so. And what is great about all three of those productions is that Potter, Fellini, and Fosse are all very interesting people. because you know, you know, you want to make an autobiography about a very dull person, because quite honestly, sometimes some people, even like some writers, are just, and some writers just have lived very dull lives, you know. But you know, with Fellini, Fosse, and Potter, they were all very fascinating people and great artists as well. So,
yeah. So, Aaron, what about you?
Here, watch this. I'm going to give them the same guidance that you, Adam, gave me. Here, watch this. I don't want them to know anything going in, because I think they deserve to see it with fresh eyes.
That's great. It is. To say, watch this, it's great. That's all you got to know. Right?
Yep.
Because you don't want to lay it out for them, like, oh, this happens and this happens, this scene might be, you know, no. Just throw, it's like, you know, it's like throwing them into the shallow end. Okay, learn to swim in the shallow end, and then you can approach the deeper end at the other end of the pool, you know.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. Harry said, like, by the end of it, you don't have any questions left. So it's actually, like, it's a hallucinatory work, and you will get lost in it. But at the end, you know where you stand. And so it's not complicated in that way. You don't have a lot to work through if you're paying attention to it. So why give them everything up front? Just throw them in.
Yeah. So here's a question. You know, we all know how great Michael Gambon is, and we've talked about that, and we'll talk about it a little bit more. But is there anyone in the cast who we think deserves a shout out? So I will go back to you, Gregory. Is there anyone in this that you think, yeah, damn, they did a great job and they deserve to be lauded along with Gambon for this?
Yeah, when I think about it, like, of course, Janet Susman, who plays his wife, is good. Joanna Wally is good. Some of the doctors are good. But you know who actually gives a really good performance is the kid who plays Dennis, or who plays Marlowe as a kid. That I don't know the actor's name, but I remember seeing those scenes, and he's so poignant and sad, watching this teacher like pick on him and be rude to him, and you know, and he just wants to cry, but he can't. You know, his performance is quite good. You know, directing children is somewhat tricky because sometimes they have a tendency to overact, or they get scared, so you have to handle them in ways you don't handle adults. But when it works, it works brilliantly, and he was really good in that film.
Oh yeah. And you know, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because Potter has done a lot of work where kids are the focus, because there's something about childhood. I'm thinking particularly Blue Remembered Hills. Now, in the case of Blue Remembered Hills, you had adults playing kids, but you still had kids. So it's interesting that, you know, you chose a child actor, because I think Potter really does know how to write children.
He does, so, actually, because children are nuanced, even though they may themselves not know it. Too often you get either children are totally innocent, and then also sometimes you get they're completely evil, and it's usually in between. A lot of times, if they're doing bad things, they're not really aware of it, you know, and sometimes, yeah, children can be just as nuanced as adults. Sometimes writers forget about that, but Potter doesn't. Potter doesn't at all. He understands that.
So, yeah. So, Perry, what about you?
Okay, I'll say three things. First of all, I don't think there's a wrong answer here. Pick whoever you want. I think everybody's superb. Like, I don't think there's any, you know, we'll call them first among seconds. For me, my favorite scenes in the movie, and again, this is just a prejudice, I like scenes like this. I love all the scenes with the psychiatrist. So, I will throw the nod there. But,
yeah.
But having said that, my favorite moment from anybody, and the thing I will probably carry with me longest that doesn't directly involve Michael Gambon, is Imelda Staunton's reaction to being shot in the last gigantic movie, which is so screamingly funny and so very British that that's a glorious, that's just a hysterically funny moment. And that'll stick with me for a long time. So I'll give you those answers.
Yeah, that could, yeah. The psychiatrist is played really well. I can't remember. He's a Scottish actor. He was in the miniseries Traffic. He played the
Bill Patterson.
Yeah, Bill Patterson. There you go. Thank you. And he's tremendous. And they don't play him as a stuffy guy. You know, he goes back and forth with Gambone a lot. You know, mm-hmm. He's not this like quiet. Oh yeah, need to talk. I'm here to listen. You know, he gets into it with him, and I like that.
You can't talk to me this way. Then
yeah.
I'll be polite. F-U-C-K-O-F-F.
Instead of seeing the overly, like, kind, you know, like, almost angelic psychiatrist, and like, you know, say no. They're not always like that. In fact, I think a lot of psychiatrists are messed up as their patients are. That's why they get into psychiatry. And that's just...
So, Aaron, what about you?
Well, I can't do this segment without once again mentioning his trinity of women. So, Joanne Wally, his wife, who was mentioned, Jeanette Suzman, and Allison Steadman as the mother, loved Jim Carter as his dad. Just give a shout out there. The two men on the other side of the ward, though,
yes.
Who were there completely mm-hmm. for comedic relief, they had some scene-stealing moments. And I do not know either actor's name who played those two characters, but they're literally just there to complain that the nurse always goes the same way around the ward, and they're always the last to get served. And then the one is reading Marlowe's book and doesn't realize that Marlowe is the guy that they're always complaining about yelling. So there's a lot of really funny moments with those two. And since they hadn't been mentioned, I thought I'd give them a shout out, despite not knowing their names.
So, finally, is this a writer's showcase, as most claim, or is it more of an actor's and director's showcase?
I'll go first here.
Yeah, and I was going to go to you, Gregory. Yep, you get to start this one. So,
well, this one's a little different than Pennies from Heaven. Pennies from Heaven is definitely more of a writer. It's Potter dominates that. The visuals aren't as interesting, but with Singing Detective, it has a bigger, has a deeper cinematic sense to it than Pennies from Heaven. So I would say that it is still like Potter, the auteur, right? The writer showcased the great acting, but John Emile gives it a really good, like, cinematic sheen to it, right? And even though it's shot full frame, it's shot on 16, I believe it was shot 16 millimeter. They always used to shoot television series on 16, so I'm going to assume that one was as well. But it's still, it does have a cinematic touch to it, much more than Pennies from Heaven did. So I would say, yeah, definitely, it's still Potter's child, right? It's still Potter's baby, but, you know, Emile's direction is really good. And the actors, of course, are fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Aaron?
I guess I'll agree with that. The direction has such a vivid tone to it. And part of the reason that you're never lost is because of how clear-eyed the direction is. Those pulp scenes are so scuzzy, and I mean that in the best way, that you can feel the 1940s noir just slime in those scenes. The hospital scenes are polar opposite. They're very whitewashed. They're very what's the word I'm looking for? Antiseptic. They're clean. The scenes with the psychiatrist are augmented from the hospital sequences, but they're a little warmer. So you never have to doubt where you're at. Oh, and the scenes from his childhood are seen through some of the most beautiful, clear-eyed nostalgia that I've ever seen, despite the fact that it's really quite a tragic story that's being told of his childhood.
You know, there's one scene in particular visually in the childhood where, like, the camera's on a crane, if I remember it right, and when the child climbs up the tree, the camera follows him up the tree,
mm-hmm.
right? And I remember there's a really great shot in Full Metal Jacket during the boot camp sequence when, you know, Arlie Emery's on top and Private Pyle's climbing up, and he's mocking him, right? And, you know, that's the line where he goes, you climb obstacles like old people will fuck, you know that? So, and the camera's on the ground, and it literally, like, rises up as Pyle is walking up, and then it stays up while Emery is shouting at Pyle, insulting him, right? And then Pyle goes back down, and the camera goes back down. There's a scene like that in Singing Detective. It's really, really well done. It's almost
it's
like an exact
copy. It's
interesting
that both of you have described the visuals because originally Potter, and he objected to what happened. He wanted the series to be shot on both film and videotape. He wanted the scenes in the hospital to be shot on videotape and done, you know, in the way of, say, a television sitcom. And
mm-hmm.
then he wanted everything else to be done on film. The whole series ended up on film, but he, in particular, did not like the fact that they decided to shoot the whole thing in color because Marlowe's childhood was supposed to be black and white. I think that would have been interesting, but
I think that would have been a mistake, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think it would have. I don't think it would have added
much of a stylistic flourish.
Yeah, there really wasn't any need. When I'm watching it, I was obviously all in color, and while it may have been like somewhat at first, it might have been visually interesting, but I don't think it would be necessary. I think the drama's strong enough. You know, they're flashbacks. If you make them in black and white, it's going to make them like obvious. You know, it's like flashback. You know, you don't have to do that.
Or it will make it feel like dream sequences when that's one some of the only real sequences in the
yeah,
piece.
Exactly. It could confuse the viewer.
Mhm. So you know, there's obviously a little bit more to talk about, but we haven't gotten to the one thing, Michael Gambon. So so Perry, Michael Gambon.
Yeah, anytime, anywhere, for any reason, of course. What doesn't he do over the course of his 7 hours other than sing his own song? I mean, he is everything you could ask of any performer throughout the entire thing. He is funny. He is in pain. He is absolutely, resolutely makes himself as unlikable as possible when he's supposed to, and is never anything less than utterly engaging even when he can't move. I don't know what else to say. This is one of
and
the greatest performances
sure
in anything ever.
Oh, it absolutely is. I have a choice for my choice for strongest performance in British television history, and it's Bernard Hill in Boys from the Black Stuff. But that's a whole different beast. But I did want to make sure, did we get to you, did you get to answer what you think in terms of that last question, more of a writer's or director's showcase?
I would have said this comes down to the, you know, with the caveat that we all understand that unless we've seen the script, we have no idea. This is absolutely Dennis Potter's work. Not that other people don't deserve a lot of credit for helping bring it along, but my question would be, I'd like to know how much of that editing was on the page. That's the question I have. When it goes into those some of those very fast montages where things really start to blur together, I'm curious if that was on the page or not. And that's really where I would give more credit to Emil for those sequences, if they weren't there, than for how it looked. And not that it looks bad. I just think all those decisions were the right ones. And I don't know. The kids stuff might have worked in Black and White. I would give it a shot. Why not?
You know, I think for me, even if it is, let's say that it was on the page, I'm going to give Potter credit for coming up with it and Emil credit for making it work.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. It's still a Potter series. I mean, as we talked about, the actors and director, they bring it along and they contribute some great stuff, but it's still his work. It's sort of like in a rock band where, like, the main songwriter writes the songs, and the other band members bring their arranging ideas, but it's still his, you know, it's still their song. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
The Pete Townsend of this. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pete Townsend.
So Gregory, what about you and your thoughts on Gambone in this?
Oh, Gambone he's great in everything. When we started talking about this, I always remember him as Albert Spica in The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, which I think came out 3 years after
that.
Yeah, it came out 3 years after this. Yeah, Philip Marlowe like manifested himself into Albert Spica and then became it was in The Cook and the Thief. But yeah, Gambone is really great actor because he could play like, you know, nice people, he could play cruel people. And play people in between, like he isn't like in Singing Detective. He's a bastard, but you know you still kind of like him. And then in The Cook and the Thief, he's completely, you know, there's nothing likable about
monster.
Him at all. Yeah, but you know that's his character's written that way, you know.
Yep.
And only once or twice does he does anything kind, but it's just, you know, it doesn't matter. He's just overall just a horrible person.
So, what about you, Aaron? Your thoughts on Gambone in this?
He was amazing. he's a guy that I know as a character actor. I know him as an older character actor for the most part. And so seeing him in his late 30s, early 40s, late 30s,
yeah,
I guess mid 40s. He was about, 46. When he made this, and in a truly starring role, and pulling off a character who is just totally unlikable but totally sympathetic at the same time, that's a feat. as much as we want to praise Potter and or Emil, if Gambon doesn't pull off Philip Marlowe, it doesn't work at all. And it doesn't matter how well it's written.
Yeah.
Because that's a
casting is like
character.
Casting's like 90% of it, or actually it's almost 100%. You're right. If you have the greatest writing in the world, the best director, if you miscast, your film goes south very quickly and doesn't recover, you know.
Yep. So, we have a couple more things I want to get to real quick, but we're coming towards the end of this, I think. So I'm going to take a short moment to do some station identification type things. What we will do is I will say that Carl wanted me to say that tomorrow there will be an ISF episode where they're having a commentary watch of Cry Uncle. Then on Tuesday, another ISF episode where it is The Legacy of George Pal with director Arnold Liebovit. On Thursday, there will be an In Memoriam episode of ISF concerning director Richard Rush with Gary Warner Kent and Noel Vera as the guests. And then Carl's Cavern on Monday will have, Monday, April 26th, that is, we'll have the memorial podcast for Deviant Legion friend and author Derek Ferguson, who died recently. And I will take this moment to say that my own show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back next week with an episode on our favorite series finales. As for what's coming up the week after that, that's actually in the air. But, coming up shortly after that, well, sometime in early May, we will have an episode spotlighting the work of director Spike Lee. So that's what's coming up over the next few weeks for Cathode Ray Mission. So now back to our show. yes, Gregory?
I was just going to say maybe you should do a show on just like really, really – we always do shows on like stuff we like. Maybe we should do a show on like really bad 80s sitcoms or something like that.
That's coming. Yeah, that's coming. I'm thinking something to kill the time during the summer.
Because I was talking about that with a friend of mine and all the cheesy like theme songs and how some of them are actually pretty creepy now, you know? Yeah.
Come and knock on my door.
You know that Three's Company is extremely cringeworthy now.
Yeah.
Oh man, and that's just one example.
And it's a shame because there are a couple of people in there that were actually really talented, not least of which is John Ritter.
John Ritter, Don Knotts, Norman Fell.
Yeah, those are the two I'm thinking of.
Yeah. You know, Norman Fell had a really good career. He was ahead of all those character actors. Like, he was in The Graduate. He pops up in a lot of stuff. And he's also in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World as well. And then ends up being Mr. Roper on this rather, you know, cringy show.
Terrible show.
Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, we talked a little earlier. I wanted to get back to this because I think this is interesting. We talked a little bit about long-form television in terms of the miniseries is, you know, people talk about it as short form, but in a way it's long form because it's a short story, but at the same time it takes a shorter story than what you get in an ongoing saga like The Wire or The Sopranos or Seinfeld. And it's not a movie, but it has a movie feel in that it was designed to have a beginning, a middle, and an end and tell a definite story from the start. So where does this really fit in terms of the way it utilizes the short form or the long form storytelling, the miniseries that's more than just like 2 or 3 hours long, this 5, 6, 10, 20-hour miniseries thing that we have. I'll start with you, Gregory, since you're the one that brought it up.
You mean like how does the Singing Detective fit in like with like the history or the tradition of like long form television or like short
yeah,
form?
Yeah, and do you think it uses the form well and? Some thoughts in general on it. So it's kind of like a three-prong question.
Yeah. The series roughly runs, I think, about 7 hours. It's never, you know, it's really well, you know, I can't remember, like, any times where it has, like, a little lull, right? So it's beautifully made. The writing is solid. You know, it's Potter, obviously. The direction is solid. So he really utilizes that 7 hours really well. There's no padding in it. Like I've talked to this about friends of mine, and I think we've talked about it. Like a lot of TV shows today, and a lot of films as well, you know, feel padded. Like they're just, you know, they're like, oh, we can't come up with something. So let's just, just basically remake the previous episode and just, you know, tell everybody to speak in low, slow, hushed tones and just drag it out for 50 minutes. Back in the 70s and 80s, if the writers, like, hit a dry spot, they would just do a clip show or a variety show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in terms of singing effective, it really uses the form well. You're never bored. It's very visceral, and yet it's human. It's, in a strange way, it's very humanistic, because like people were saying, you actually care about this character, even though he's not a particularly nice person. You have sympathy for him because, you know, of his suffering, of his, you know, the skin conditions of the disease. So I think it utilizes it really well, and it's not self-indulgent either. It's a perfectly tight 7 hours, right? So that's a good thing. Pennies from Heaven, even though that was a little longer, that was like a solid 8.5 hours. So it's like Potter has a story. Potter worked with both shorts, you know, short, because we talked about, he did like those three films I talked about earlier for television, Blade on the Feather.
He did a lot of the Wednesday plays, which were like 75 minutes long.
Right. So yeah, he knew construction. Right, he knew, like, if he had a short, you know, if he had 75 minutes, it was something that needed to be 75. If he did the singing detective, pace from him, something extended, he knew how to do that. So yeah, he was really a master of the medium.
Yeah, I mean, not the least of which is he did everything from comedies to dramas and musicals. He did a show about Jesus called Son of Man, all the way up to a science fiction duology that doesn't appear as such based on its first part, Karaoke, but definitely when you get to its last, Cold Lazarus, which happens to star Albert Finney. So there you go. So what about you, Perry? Your thoughts?
It's hard to talk about this without, you know, getting into, you know, my biases, my taste. I am dubious of things at this length. But now I'm not saying it's impossible to make something great. It obviously is. I prefer the exactitude of working in a 2 to 3 hour time limit if you're going to tell a story. And this obviously blows that to shreds fantastically. I don't wish it to be any shorter. However, that said, you know, if it wasn't going to get made at that length and someone said, I'll give you 5 hours, I think you could trim this to 5 hours, and I don't think it would hurt that much. I'm not saying it's padded. I'm just saying you would have a few less avenues to go down, which, yes, would not be as good as this 7-hour version, but would it be a total loss to the world? I don't know. I still think it'd be pretty damn great. So, you know, it is a fun thing to consider. If you're going to spend 7 hours, oh, my God, do it like this. but, you know, I guess the most polite way to answer this is I prefer all that jazz.
And Aaron, you?
Well, obviously, it can't be trimmed down too much because, as Adam has pointed out, and every critic who saw it at the time, the feature-length version is garbage. And it obviously couldn't be stretched out into a full TV show because it would be a mess. Everything that makes it interesting is that it is self-contained. So I think it's a piece that is exactly what it needs to be. Perry's probably right. It could probably be trimmed to 5 hours without hurting the quality too much, but I think it would hurt. And I don't think you could stretch it much more without hurting it. Once you get past about 10 hours, you're really not talking about a miniseries anymore.
Right.
I mean,
no.
It's something different. I mean, it is still a miniseries. Really, anything that's a season or less and self-contained is technically a miniseries. But that's something different. Like, you often mention Hymet on your mini series list, and that's
I was just
60
that.
Hours.
That's the
Wire.
Yeah, the second part of Hymet is 26 hours long, or 26 and a half.
Right. So, even something like Berlin Alexanderplatz, it's that's a season of television. It's also actually a movie that they actually showed in the theaters. So that's a little bit of a hybrid situation there.
Yeah, and I think War and Remembrance / Winds of War is something like 35 to 40 hours long if you watch the whole damn thing.
Yeah, I think North and South is really long, too, something like 20 hours.
Oh, God. I have to say, I actually liked North and South and Heaven and Hell, but North and South, Heaven and Hell, Love and War, they were all good, but that third series, man, that wasn't good. But then again, neither was that last book.
No, I'm thinking about Blue and the Gray, which was also not very good.
No, it's not.
I think that this was perfectly executed for what it was. I think that it was exactly what it needed to be. If I can borrow from possibly an outmoded philosophy of media now, the medium's the message. I think this is kind of this is what you're looking for when you're looking at a miniseries, is you're looking for something that's probably like 5.5 to 9 hours, tells a single story, a self-contained story anyway. And this does that wonderfully. It's a star of the medium.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and you know, that's why, you know, you look at something like Bergman with Fanny and Alexander, and that's, what, 5.5 hours long, the full version? And for me, that is the perfect miniseries. And a lot of that has to do with how well the size of it is managed. Because, you know, I mean, I'm not one for thinking that, okay, every comedy has to be 90 minutes and every drama has to be 2 hours. Mm. But I do think that you can misuse your size.
Yeah.
It's like one of my favorite comedies is It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which runs, you know, almost like 2 hours and 45 minutes. But I think it's fantastic. Even though there is a somewhat restored version, it runs like 3, but they use like stills and like, you know, missing footage and audio covers it. But so anyway, so yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's a comedy. It doesn't have to be long. It's, you know, it's like what Frank Capra said. He said there are no rules in filmmaking, only sins, and the cardinal sin is boredom. You know, if you're just sitting, and it goes for television too. I mean, you just have to keep, you know, Kurosawa even said, you just have to make sure your film is interesting. It's really a very simple description of what we do. Well, we just need to make an interesting movie or television show. Just keep the audience interested.
I think Roger Ebert said that it was, I believe he was talking about Tom Shales. I think he said Tom Shales gave him a watch that lit up in a theater, and he said, oh, thank you, but why the watch? He said, so that you know what time it is when you want to leave a bad movie. He said, well, how will I know it's a bad movie? And he was joking, and Shales took him seriously and said, because, Roger, as we've discussed before, it's when you become aware that your ass is sitting in the seat.
Ebert also said it really well. He said a good movie can never be too long and a bad movie can never be too short.
Right.
His notable exception was Love Actually. A very good movie that is too long.
Yeah.
And all this is putting in mind of, I can't remember, is it Hawks or Ford who had the, I think it was Hawks who had the line about how a great movie is a movie with no bad scenes and 3 good ones.
Yeah, right. I think it was Hawks that said that.
Is it Hawks? Yeah, it sounds like Hawks. It sounds much more like
Hawks. Yeah, you just
need
3 good
scenes. Well, Hawks,
I
can't remember who he was talking to, but Hawks was trying to get someone to do a later movie of his, and they said, well, how do I know that this is going to be worth it? And he told the actor, oh, you know me, characters, lots and lots of characters.
Yes.
But, you know, that's the thing. I think the miniseries really is an interesting form. You know, it can feel like a large movie at times. It can feel like a set of films, particularly in the case of something like Haimod, which its director sees it not as a series or a miniseries, but as three or four epic films that tell a single story. You know, I definitely think that this is one of the shining examples of the miniseries form, and very worth covering. So, Perry, is there anything that we have not covered that you'd like to mention?
Is there? I don't think so. Well, that felt like a pretty definitive take on the singing detective thing.
So what about you, Gregory?
I just want to mention there's a lot of, you know, there's some good musical numbers in the series. And in some ways, I mean, they're not like choreographed as well as Hollywood, but they're a little bit more like smoother than the ones in Pennies from Heaven, at least in terms of the choreography, or at least in the way they're filmed, too. Because the musical numbers were all filmed in the studio in the three camera setups on video. And as we know, Singing Detective is all shot on film, so I think it looks better. There's that old, that old Bing Crosby standard, you know, accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. I like that sequence. And also the one where they do the dem bones, right?
Oh, yeah.
Dry them bones, them. My bones, Ezekiel cried them, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly I can think in the first or second episode, and that song was famously used in the Prisoner finale. So.
Yep. Well, that's actually the only thing I told Aaron to watch it. I said, go forth and watch this, knowing nothing but these two words, dem bones. You'll know what I mean when you see it.
I actually love that song. I want to put that in a movie someday. I don't know where, but I'll do it.
Yeah.
Maybe plop it in the middle, and you guys will be like, hey, he said he was going to do that. Hey, that's cool.
Woo-hoo.
Doesn't make any thematic sense, but, you know, hey, it's still fun, you know?
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Aaron?
He stole my thunder. I was going to say that I was really enjoying the first episode, and then this magical insanity that was the dem bones sequence happened, and all of a sudden I knew that I had found a long lost friend.
It spoke
to me on a visceral level, and I'm a bit of a surrealism scholar and nerd and all of that, and so seeing that sequence just really kicked my view of this into another gear.
Yeah, and Potter is not afraid to go weird places. So I will say that if you or anybody listening thinks this sounds good, or if this is all you've seen of him and you're wondering if you should see more, the answer is yes. I think Potter is probably the greatest dramatist that British television has ever seen. He's one of the best writers the medium of television has ever seen. He is an extraordinary talent. I could do another show on him.
And he's also great. He's also great when he's interviewed too.
Oh yeah, that final interview is extraordinary. It really, really is. You know, I think your response, Aaron, to Dem Bones, the person I watched this with a few years back when I saw it the first time, they weren't sure what to think of it. But once Dem Bones happened, after they picked their jaw off the floor, they sat there smiling for the next 2 or 3 hours as we watched another few episodes, went off to do something else, and then came back and said, we have to finish the rest of it. So I ended up watching all of it in, like, one day with a couple of breaks. But that sequence I think that sequence really does have a knack for hooking people. I wonder if that was part of the intent, or if it was just Potter saying, ah, fuck it, I'm going to throw something weird out here, and if you can't stand it, then fuck you. You know, trying to weed out the
weak. One time somebody asked Tarkovsky about that sequence in Solaris where they're driving and it goes on for like 4 or 5 minutes, and he said the reason he kept it so long was because he wanted the idiots to who got bored to leave the theater. So so maybe that's what Potter was doing with that scene.
And I'm curious if he didn't do it specifically to quote the prisoner to let people know, all right, so you're not comfortable, that's okay. Remember, you didn't know what was going on before, it's fine. Just stick with me, it's all going to be good.
I love that prisoner finale. It's just so ambiguous, and like it just outraged everybody in England. I heard that McGowan had to leave England for a while. Things cooled down.
Oh,
he did. And this was before social media. Can you imagine like doing that today with social media? My God. They'd be hounding him on Twitter, Facebook. It wouldn't matter where he would go. But I remember watching that. I was like, this is great.
So, you know, I think that just about brings us to the end. So, as usual, I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank you guys for coming on and taking part in this. It was really great getting to talk about such a fantastic series, such a landmark. I know I call a lot of these landmarks, but we really are hitting some of the all-time best shows here.
We're not discussing the complex ambiguities of Silver Spoons or Different Strokes or anything like that. So
No.
Don't rule out the incredible examination of race in America that was Different Strokes. Don't
also, what are you talking about, Gregory?
Yes.
For
so,
the complexities of go ahead. Sorry.
No, so I was just going to say, so I think with that I will put a cap on this episode, but as always, we definitely will have you guys back. Aaron, once you've seen GBH, let me know, we'll figure out a time that works for you and Gregory, and we'll get that episode going, because that's one that I've been really champing at the bit to do, but I haven't found the guests, and it seems I finally have, so maybe we can push that to sometime in May even. Maybe we can even do GBH next month or in June.
Yeah, I would be definitely up for that.
Yeah, I think that would be great. So I want to say goodnight to everyone, and on the count of three, we will do just that and call this one a wrap. 1, 2, 3. Good night, folks.
Goodbye.
Good night, everybody.